Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for 220K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, and today we're speaking to TV producer Ted Yacucci. Hello, Mr. Yacucci.
Hello, Len. It's so good to be with you again.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to people doing good work, and I've been following your channel. You've been branching out into YouTube videos, and you've been quite productive, and I can see that you've got a lot of subscribers and viewers. It's just great compared to, you know, the people who are still out there arguing that it was a lone assassin and the Warren Commission had it right. That's just so pointless. But here you're doing good work, and that's what I'm interested in, and I want to help promote. And in case anyone didn't know of the good work you're doing, they'll hear of you now again today. So
awesome.
Good. Tell us a little bit about your channel, just how you started it, and then we'll get into your latest episode or two.
Okay, great. First of all, I just want to say congratulations to you, because I haven't finished it yet, but I watched the new documentary about Fletcher Prouty, which features interviews with you all throughout, and you just did an amazing job on that documentary. So congratulations on that. That's excellent. And anybody that hasn't seen that documentary, you've got to watch it. So I just want to throw that out there.
Thanks. Because, you know, although I found Fletcher Prouty very important, just unparalleled, because he was talking about stuff. If you went to his house and interviewed him, he would tell you matter-of-factly how things worked. And I was just surprised that nobody else, not more people, have done it. And then you get people that are, you know, like I call them the Flat Earth Society, still claiming, like the Bugliosis or whatever, that the Warren Commission had it right. And they don't like Fletcher for whatever reason, right? So it's kind of a feather there to say, okay, here's a documentary just proving it, where he was, the documents that he had, where he really worked, and how high up in the Pentagon he was briefing the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And one of the best things about that is that after we got Oliver Stone involved, he wrote a very, very nice note to me saying how magnificent he thought the whole thing was, and that he was proud to be part of it. And that was like a real feather in our cap, me and Jeff Carter.
Well, it's excellent. And I highly, highly recommend that everybody that has even a cursory interest in the JFK assassination, you've got to watch this documentary. So check that out as soon as possible. And then the other thing that I just wanted to say before we get started is that I also want to congratulate you on being a rock star. I'm waiting for your band to tour the East Coast of the U.S. so I can come see you in a mega stadium, because I know that you guys are very, very popular out there. I can see all the comments on Facebook and stuff. So congratulations on your musical career, buddy.
Okay, well, as you may know, I've been running a recording studio for 46 years, so I'm almost ready to wind down and retire. So, but I'm still playing. Yeah.
That's great. As far as my YouTube channel goes, which is really just my name, Ted Yacucci, I've been interested in the JFK assassination forever and done a lot of research, especially in two areas, the Chicago plot and Ruth and Michael Payne, where it was original research, but I've been really interested in all aspects of the assassination. And because I also am a very old person now, I retired the end of last year, and I've been able to spend a lot more time doing the things that I really want to do. And at the top of that list is continuing my personal interest in investigating the assassination and all the associated events. And that's why I've been able to post more frequently on the YouTube channel. And I've been very, grateful that people seem to like the content. So that's kind of where that got started.
Great. I'm just so happy that all these different topics you're writing. It kind of reminds me of my effort, 50 Reasons for 50 Years. And here you got all these different varied topics, but you're really diving into them, right? Like they're not 3-minute videos. Some of them are, at least half an hour, roughly around there, 20 minutes.
I'm trying to hit that sweet spot between, plain research is so boring, and people just don't want to sit and listen to fact after fact without any kind of, entertainment type of input along with it. So what I've been trying to do is just make them as, add a little bit of both entertainment and information in the videos to try to not make them too boring. I mean, looking at me is boring enough, so I want to make sure that I get as much as much content in there to really give people not just information about one topic, the topic that maybe we're talking about, but how it relates to all the other topics that surround the JFK assassination, and how all the information kind of meshes together, so that when you step back, which I think is often necessary in exploring the assassination of John Kennedy, I think a lot of times you have to step back, as you know better than anyone, and you have to say, well, my goodness, why is this happening over here? Well, it has to be because of what was happening over here and here and here. So that's one of the things that I try to do, is just try to put things in context so that it doesn't seem like a sole fact. But hopefully, where who's ever viewing the video, hopefully by the end that they can just kind of get a feel for how whatever topic we're talking about, how it kind of fits in the whole mosaic of the JFK assassination.
Well, it's a very good point and a good observation, because if somebody sends me like an hour and a half or 2 hour video documentary or something, like I go, oh, how am I going to get through this? Or if I see something like, 11 minutes long, I go, okay, I can handle that. Let's turn it on, right? And there's a lot of things like that when you get into this topic. If you get right to the nitty gritty, you don't have to go an hour and a half. You can, okay, I'm going to focus on this, like the gun. Where did that rifle come from? How did he buy it? And whatever. And you can get right down to that thing. How many videos roughly do you have here? I see quite a few.
Well, I would guess it's about 75, something like
Oh,
that.
yeah, right. Okay, wonderful. Wonderful.
Today, I don't know if it's up to you. We'll talk about, anything that you want to talk about, but I have three kind of topics over the last three videos that I did that I thought we could kind of just touch base on. And that
Oh,
would
good.
be.
Let's do that, and let's do more than touch. Tell me what got you excited to make them, and what was the catalyst that you decided to present it
Cool.
to the
Very,
community?
very good. Well, let me just give you the folks the three topics that I'm going to just hopefully hit on. One is a topic that I've often shied away from, which is who were the actual shooters in Dealey Plaza on the day that Kennedy was killed. To me, it never mattered, because they were just the people that were pulling the triggers, and all that really matters is the people that put them there. But I did have some what I consider some insight on it, so I just want to touch base on that. And then the next thing would be James Files. I know there are a lot of folks that really believe James Files' story. I'm not one of them, and I wanted to take a little bit of time. I'm not putting down anybody that believes James Files, and who knows? Who knows? But I just wanted to give my reasoning a little bit of why I think James Files maybe is not really accurate. And then the last thing was a video that was about a guy that most people don't really know about, and that was a guy named Igor Vaganov, or Vaganov, however you pronounce it, who was a guy that was really intensely involved in the murder of Officer Tippett. He was a guy that has a really crazy story, and I thought that I could spend a little bit of time just on making people aware of who he was and how maybe he fits into the J.D. Tippett shooting.
Okay, let's go.
All right, number one, if I may, again, if I wanted to tell you that I knew who the shooters were on Dealey Plaza, I would certainly be lying. I like everyone else, I can just give my opinion. But one thing that occurred to me and keeps coming back in my limited brain is that, we have to remember what happened on November 2nd, 1963, and that was the Chicago plot, where there were four probably Cuban shooters that were identified who were going to try to assassinate President Kennedy from the IPP lithoplate factory on Jackson Street as his motorcade made its way from O'Hare Airport to Soldier Field for the Army Air Force football game. Eventually, two of those shooters were taken into custody due to a tip from someone named Lee that I argue was Lee Oswald. But the point that I want to get here is that those two shooters, two out of the four Cuban-looking shooters identified by a woman in a kind of a house, rooming house is what I'm trying to think of, with long guns and maps of the parade route, of the motorcade route. Two of those shooters were taken into custody when the Secret Service blew their cover the night before the motorcade was scheduled. So it would have been on November 1st. And they were interviewed all night by two Secret Service agents named Stocks and D'Amato. Now, all of the information, as is made very, very clear by Edwin Black, who did the original investigation that was printed in a publication called The Independent. But one of the most interesting aspects of that whole story is that all of that information that should have been easily available, not only was it bottled up by Secret Service head James Rowley in a direct order to Maurice Martineau, who was the Secret Service agent in charge in Chicago. But even I've been to Chicago twice trying to follow up on the story. I know a lot of other people have. My FOIA requests have never gotten anywhere. But what we don't know is even the names of the two Cuban, probably paramilitary shooters that were investigated all night. And I find that incredible. And I think that maybe the reason is that it still enabled all of those shooters to be available for Dallas 3 weeks later. And my thought process in this is that why not bring them to Dallas? You've got shooters that are trained shooters that fit the bill of being Cuban and anti-Castro Cuban paramilitary types. If they had been captured, or if they had been killed, or if they had been given up somehow in Dallas, well, we know what would have happened. We know that the CIA, through Operation Mockingbird and all of their media assets, would have right away said that the Cuban shooters were part of hit teams sent by Fidel Castro, and the American people would have been fed that lie. So I think that people don't really take the possibility of those shooters in Chicago actually being brought down to Dallas. I don't think people really look at that seriously enough. When you've got people that are motivated, dedicated, trained, and ready to go, a lot of times you don't really want to change those assets if you have a chance to use them. So my contention is that the shooters in Dealey Plaza, now there may be others, and I do believe that a guy named Jean Sweter, or I called him Jean Soutre, a French OAS agent, was was definitely in Dallas, and I believe he also was one of the shooters. He also trained with the he trained the anti-Castro Cubans for 2 months. He visited General Edwin Walker. He visited Howard Hunt. He did a lot of other things that would make anyone believe that he was also in Dallas. So I believe that it was the shooters in Dallas most likely were hit teams that were trained as anti-Castro paramilitary types, and I believe this French shooter was also part of the shooters that very possibly were in Dealey Plaza. Now, there's probably a lot of other people that were there too, both as cover teams. We know there were fake Secret Service agents, of course, behind the grassy knoll and in the vicinity of the Texas School Book Depository. So it was a big, massive operation, in my opinion. But I believe that not enough credence and not enough emphasis is put on the fact that the shooters probably were part of these Cuban paramilitary teams. And that was kind of one of the elements that I was trying to cover in that video. And the other thing that I did was I kind of went through who the very popular guesses from everyone are as shooters, the Mack Wallaces and the Roscoe Whites and the James Files and Charles Nicolettis, all of those people. And I tried to give reasons why, while it's certainly not impossible, and I certainly don't know for sure, I tried to give reasons why I didn't think those people were actually part of the shooting teams. So anybody that wants to kind of check out that video, again, this is my opinion, just based on the research that I've done. Everyone is free, of course, to have their own views. And I know a lot of people who believe Roscoe White, for instance, was involved. I also believe Roscoe White was an integral part of the assassination plans. I just don't think he was a shooter. But if it was proved that Roscoe White was a shooter, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think that, he very well could have been involved. I just don't think that the preponderance of evidence leads that way, at least in my opinion. So that was one of the first things that I just wanted to, to throw out there. What do you think, Len? Do you have any overall beliefs of who you think the shooters might have actually been?
Well, I defer to the answer given by John Judge when somebody pressed him on it. Where do you think the shots came from? And he said they came from Washington.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
That's exactly
So,
it.
therefore, the people who were hired, did you ever see that movie Shooter?
I have seen parts of it, yes.
Oh, well, they're talking to an old guy and he says, this would be a bad job to take. It's like those guys on the grassy knoll, right? They're dead 45 minutes later. And he
Yeah.
goes, "How do you know that?" He goes, "I still got the shovel."
Yeah.
So, who fired is it's a change of government. It's to
Yeah.
me, it was more interesting of who planned it and how
Exactly.
did they get away with it?
Right.
And, then who's behind it?
Right.
Right? Back to the John Judge thing that whoever was hired, who's a, and when you say Cubans, ex-Cubans, they're not working for Castro.
Right.
That would be the implication. And I often thought that there would be maybe phony people planted there, like two, second, third tier, that if anything goes wrong, they got somebody to arrest.
Yes.
So it reminds me of the tramp. So they should look at the photographers are going to be there. And if this is not the first time you plan something like this, they're going to want to see something. So march these guys right down the main plaza and let everybody look at them and take pictures of them while other guys are sneaking out.
Right. I mean, I think that anybody that doesn't believe the CIA was the driving factor behind the assassination, is just needs to do a little bit more research. And I think that, in my opinion, these anti-Castro paramilitary types would have been the perfect shooters. But again, I'm like you. I never really cared in 40 years of research. I never cared who the shooters were because it never made any difference. They're just hired assassins. The only thing that matters is the people that hired them, the people that put them there. Exactly right.
And then the same thing could be said for Jack Ruby, that examine his family tree and all his ties and everything, but he wasn't behind everything. He was forced to go in and act. I think Oswald was supposed to have been shot somewhere else, maybe, in the back alley of the theater. Maybe he was supposed to be on a plane and flown out to Cuba, and then they would chase after him and say, "Castro planned this. Let's go," right? Who knows? Maybe that was Tippett's job. He was supposed to drive him to the Redbird Field, and then he said, "No, I'm not going. What the hell's going on here?" Anyway, yeah, there's a lot of maybes, but if it was obvious, we would have found out about it by now. I
Absolutely.
just mentioned on last week's interview as well that look for all the failings. Look how they got it right this time for that shooter of Trump, where Trump turned his head and just got it on the ear. I mean, that kid, there's no commission. There's no investigation. There's no congressional outrage. There's nothing. And they sanitized his house. And now, with nothing, there won't be any like HSCA, 50 years from now. There's nothing. So they figured out what went wrong. And then the JFK assassination, and maybe to some degree Bobby Kennedy, there's too many records kicking around where people are starting to piece together what happened or what didn't happen. And I think that's what I get from some of your videos. You realize, okay, if you still can't say exactly what happened, poking holes in this ridiculous Warren Commission effort.
And people forget, people forget. And again, it was a guy named Edwin Black who did all this original research in Chicago and deserves all the credit. But, because of his deep digging, we learned that the Patsy, the second tip that was given to the FBI that was turned over to the Secret Service in Chicago was about a guy named Thomas Arthur Valley, who was followed all night and then arrested the next morning, and who certainly, in my opinion, would have been the patsy to take the place of a Lee Oswald. And when you look at Valley's background, he was almost a he was almost a, his background was almost identical to Lee Oswald's background as far as serving overseas and being recruited by the same people, and it goes on and on. But the point I was wanted to make there was that the two Chicago police slash CIA agents, they were kind of even through admission of the Chicago police, they were these were two officers that were often assigned to be liaisons with the CIA. But one of the guys named Dan Groth is actually the officer that led the break-in of the home of Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers and actually fired the fatal shots that killed Hampton and a few other people that day. So when you look at the history of the people that were involved in Chicago, it leads again directly to the CIA. It's just absolutely amazing that those people, those four officers, Stocks and Motto and Groth and Sherla, who were associated with the Cuban-looking shooters and Thomas Arthur Valley, they were never called. They never did any kind of official testimony by the Warren Commission. And it just goes to show you that the Warren Commission wasn't going to call anybody that would negate their fictional story of a lone nut shooter. So, again, when you step back, it all kind of makes sense. The next thing that I wanted to talk about, if it's okay, is I just wanted to get into a little bit about James Files and at least my opinion of him. And again, I don't want to be negative into saying that anybody who believes Files, is wrong or, first of all, and I mentioned this in the video, I've stepped into probably as many rabbit holes as anybody alive when it comes to the JFK assassination. I've been brought down rabbit holes. I've believed things in my years and years and years of investigation, because you almost have to be brought down those rabbit holes if you're doing active research. You have to at least study what people are putting out, and it takes a while sometimes to realize that these people are disinformation agents or what they're saying, they just it just isn't true. Maybe they're not good researchers, or maybe they have half truths, that kind of thing. So, my emphasis with James Files is that when I listen to his both his jailhouse interviews, the original one in 1992, and then the one that Jim Mars did, I think they're full of holes. And I did a video kind of outlining, kind of laying out the specifics of where those holes were. Now, it's just been revealed within the past week that Files is now saying that he assisted Frank Sturgis and E. Howard Hunt in the actual killing of Mary Jo Kopechne in Chappaquiddick, and that it was all to threaten Ted Kennedy into not running for the presidency. And it gets pretty bizarre. So I would just suggest to people, if they are not aware of that story now, that maybe they look into that a little bit, because I think that when you look at the James Files's claims, we could go through it in detail, but the truth is that he never says anything that wasn't easily available in books up to the time where he gave the interview. And a lot of what he says could never be verified. It just can't. And then if you take what he says at face value, for instance, he was the only shooter on the knoll, well, then you're immediately the first thing you have to do is you have to throw out the testimony of people like Lee Bowers, who saw two people on the knoll before the shooting. James Files says that there was an abort and that, the mafia decided to go through with it when everybody else was standing down. Well, that doesn't make sense when you think about the three cars that Lee Bowers saw pulling through the parking lot in the 20 minutes before the assassination. The second car clearly had a driver that was on a military-grade radio. And why would he be doing that if there was an abort and he was part of, they say, a CIA hit team? It makes no sense. Of course, you'd have to throw out the Gordon Arnold and the Ed Hoffmans that have put that they were, their stories are that they were somewhere in the vicinity of the fence. You also have to look really closely at the fact that when Officer Seymour Weitzman and Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig and a couple others, when they filed affidavits saying that they ran into fake Secret Service agents, it was behind the grassy fence. They were trying to get to the parking lot behind the grassy knoll to check out cars and that kind of stuff. And that's where they were stopped. Well, Files' story is that, to me, it seems like he just became aware at the time that he was telling his story for the first time. To me, it seems like he must have just read that there were fake Secret Service agents. But he says when he got to the knoll, he noticed two guys in suits in front of the grassy knoll, in front on the plaza. Well, there's a million pictures, and where are they? They're not there, And the officers were stopped behind the grassy knoll, not in front of the grassy knoll. So that immediately becomes, just something that I don't think that he can explain. And then the other thing is that, it's 10:30 on the morning of the assassination. And, he says earlier that morning he took Johnny Roselli to Fort Worth to a pancake house where they met with Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby handed Roselli an envelope that he checked out on the way back to Dallas. And in that envelope were some, I guess he's talking about Secret Service identification, but also a map of the motorcade route. And he makes very clear that, there's the only change is that the route has been will now go down Elm Street and Houston Street and make a left on Elm Street. Well, that was in the paper the Monday before. That was in the paper 5 days before the assassination. So the fact that he's saying that they were making decisions at 10:30 when a motorcade was due at 12 noon is just insane. The other thing that he says is that when he got to Dallas on Monday before the Friday's assassination, is that he was met with a knock at the door. It was Lee Oswald, and Lee Oswald spent 5 or 6 hours every day with him for the next week up until Thursday. Well, Lee Oswald was working at the Texas School Book Depository, and he didn't have the kind of job where he could just take off 5 or 6 hours. And then when I believe it was when Jim Morris actually asked him about that at the end of his statements, you could kind of see the panic set in. And he said something, it seemed like kind of a throw-in where he goes, "Well, I did take Lee Oswald back to the vicinity of Dealey Plaza. I didn't know where he was gone each day as I let him out. He must have been gone back to the depository." But, again, it just makes absolutely no sense. We also don't have James Files was born in 1949. He went to I'm sorry, what I forget actually what year he was born in. But anyway, he turned 17 years old on January 24th of the year that he was born, so the end of January. And then he states that by July, he was being sent to Laos as a special operations instructor, not just as a soldier, but as an instructor in small arms operations and in demolition and small demolition explosives. Well, he also was joining, according to him, the 82nd Airborne, right? Which means he had to learn how to parachute. So he went in the end of January. He actually states that there was a mix-up somewhere where he was sent somewhere for 7 to 10 days before he was reassigned. So that means that at the very, very most, he only had 5 months or even less to learn how to be a paratrooper, to go through basic training, and all of the other stuff that he would have needed to learn: small arms, explosives, demolition. And he was only 17. He went in, he was only 17, so he had to wait till after his birthday to enlist. So if he's telling the truth, he had 5 months or less to learn all that, and then as a 17-year-old be sent to Laos as an instructor. And it makes, no sense to me. He also says that he was court-martialed, but he doesn't want to give any he doesn't want to give any details about the court martial. And then, then when he gets back, he says he was in a hospital for 3 months. And then on the last day that he was there, that David Atlee Phillips came and recruited him to be a CIA asset. Well, David Atlee Phillips was a head of the CIA's Mexico City and the whole hemispheric operations for the Central Intelligence Agency. Files his claim that David Atlee Phillips was his personal controller doesn't make also a whole lot of sense to me. So there's so many holes in his story that I just think that it's either either number one is just that he read a lot of books and he's having a lot of fun with this thing, or that number two, through FBI agent Zach Shelton, he's an active agent of disinformation. The fact that he would go on a show, and I do have to apologize for something here, that I was a little bit upset the day a few days ago when I saw his interview on a podcast, claiming now the Chappaquiddick murder of Mary Jo Kopechne. So I was a little rough on the guy, Jim Manning, I think is his name, that had files on because he didn't ask him any questions, and I was a little rough on him in my own YouTube video. And so, Jim Manning could be the greatest guy in the world. Everything he's done could be great. I was just commenting on. I just want to make it clear that one particular. interview where he could allow someone to make those claims and then not ask any pertinent questions about them. It just, you know, to me, all it's doing is throwing in a lot of disinformation monkey wrenches into the JFK assassination story, exactly when we seem to be making some progress through the Luna Commission and other, you know, other really good research by researchers around, including yourself, that, you know, seems to be making some really good progress here. So it seems to me like a really strange time for James Files to be claiming that the Chappaquiddick incident. And again, look at who he claims was involved. He doesn't give any names of anybody that we don't know about that we'd have to actually, you know, do some research and maybe come up with something that says, oh, wow, look at that. No, he uses the names of the people that are the most famous, E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, you know. So again, it's just, to me, it seems like an obvious attempt just to insert himself into scenarios and then because he is a good storyteller and because he is very smart. And one of the ways that I can tell that he's very smart is that if you look at his interviews, the two that he did from jail, a lot of times as an interviewer myself for years and years and years, you know, a lot of times you will ask the person that you're interviewing if they make some statements that are kind of all over the place. A lot of times you'll say, can you please put that in a complete sentence? Or can you put those two ideas in a complete sentence? And I've, you know, said that to a million Fortune 500 CEO types that I've done interviews with over the years. And invariably, they have a lot of trouble doing it because people aren't used to doing it. And it takes a little bit of practice in order to do that. People, a lot of times, take four or five tries before they're able to do it. Well, James Files, I noticed that when he was doing both interviews, he was able to do that, I mean, almost more quickly than the interviewers were asking him to do it. He is a very smart guy, in my opinion. So the fact that he is a good storyteller is of no surprise to me. So apparently he also said on that podcast, Jim Manning's podcast, is that they will have more information about other murders coming out shortly. So, you know, I think that this whole file story might get crazier, you know, as we move along. I don't know, Len, what do you think about the James Files story?
I never subscribed to it at all. I thought it was an attempt by disinformation. I mean, for somebody to say that, well, just that morning, they asked me, would you like to take part in something? I mean, knowing how they planned this for months, send people out to scout locations, you know, for instance, setting up people, other patsies, making sure Lee Oswald. I mean, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable. So I never believed it for a second. And I think way back when, a guy named Bob Vernon had contacted me, and he was the guy, I think, that first broke the story. And he was going to sell it. And then he realized it was a fraud. So he sold it to somebody for, I think, $80,000 and just got out of the whole game.
Well, let me tell you something. Wim Dankbar, who you may have had on your show. I'm not sure.
No, I don't think I have.
Okay. Well, you know, he's the one that acquired the rights. And he contacted me this week a couple of times. And it was amazing because he was trying to get me through some emails to fall for file story. And then it broke this Chappaquiddick thing. And I, you know, was kind of arguing with him through some emails. And I said, did you know that, you know, what Files just said this week about the Chappaquiddick thing? And he goes, and you could just see, I wish I could see his face. I could tell it just went white because he was sending me emails, you know, four or five straight days. And he said, no, I didn't know. And I had sent him the link and, you know, I haven't heard from him since, you know. So I think that even the people, I don't know whether they were just trying to make money on that story or what, you know, those.
Well, I think in the beginning that Bob Vernon was very interested and thought he was onto something. And then he got in so deep, and he was going to sell it to a network, and the story was a big thing. And then he got in. I mean, there was a few emails. I mean, this is like, geez, at least 20 years ago, maybe 30. And then he said, "Oh, the whole thing's a fraud. I had to recoup my money, so I quickly sold it." And as memory serves, it was about for $80,000 to recoup all the time and effort and stuff that he had put into it. And he said, "Good, somebody else can take this." And he didn't want his name attached to it any longer. Once he came to something, and I don't know what that was, but yeah. So as soon I knew that, but just nobody is asked that morning to become a shooter and
That's
assassination.
right. It's so ridiculous. Plus, he says, and I've gotten a little bit of pushback from a couple of comments, and I have to say that I'll need to do a little bit more research. But he also says that Nicoletti asked him, "Well, where do you think I should be?" And he and Files says, "Well, I think the Dow Tech's building would be great." Well, that's absolutely idiotic in the sense that, you just don't go into a building 15 minutes before you shoot, not knowing what office you're going to go to, not knowing what window you're going to go to, how you're going to get out of there, all that stuff. Now, I have heard that from a couple of folks that have been nice enough to comment that they state that there was an office on the second floor that had been set aside, was supposed to be repainted, and so that would have been available. So maybe Files and Nicoletti would have known about that. So I do want to just bring that up. But again, how could another sh where should I where do you think you should be? Well, I should be on the Knoll. Where do you think I should be? I should be in the Dow Tech building an hour before the shots ring out. It's insane. It's just absolutely insane. So, that alone, I think, is just, like you mentioned, is just absolutely crazy. So, but anyway, that was one of the videos that I did. And then the other one, if I may, is the one that I was really enjoyed doing because I've known about this guy for a long time, but even I forget about him a lot, is a guy named, and I called him Igor Vaganov through the whole YouTube video that I did. I've gotten some information from people commenting that he really pronounces it Igor Vaganov. So that is probably true. I was trying to find out the pronunciation, but I couldn't find it. So if it is Igor rather than Igor, I apologize for that. But it's really interesting. This is a guy who was born in Latvia in 1939. He moved to Germany at age two with his mother, who worked for the British government up until 1939. So I'm really thinking that, again, kind of like the Paines, they probably had a lot of intelligence connections, and my guess is that she was probably working for British intelligence from 32 to 39, but I don't know that. I can't prove it. But anyway, they immigrate to America. This guy joins the Navy in 1959 at age 19, and he serves 4.5 years. He marries a chaplain's daughter, who's a captain's daughter, and then he gets out after 4.5 years. He gets out of the Navy about 4 months before the assassination in Dallas. So it's weird. And then he goes and he does strange things from the very start. They moved to Philadelphia. He's near his mother. He gets a job at General Electric in Philadelphia as a credit manager, but he starts requesting transfers to Dallas, like the day that he gets the job. And the frequency of the request for transfers to Dallas becomes almost hilarious by the time November rolls around. So the other thing he does is he divorces his wife like right away. He buys a red Thunderbird convertible, and he starts hanging around a drugstore with an owner named Doc Orenstein, and a lot of CB radio operators meet there. They all have an interest, and they're all saying that Vaganov's CB in his new red Thunderbird convertible is way overpowered, so that he can really reach a lot of people outside of whatever area that he's in. Well, anyway, it gets really interesting really fast. This guy, November comes around, and he requests finally, the beginning of November, he requests another transfer to Dallas. So it's obvious that he needs to get to Dallas for some reason. His request is officially denied. So what does he do? He quits his job. And there's a fountain girl that he's been hitting on at Doc Ornstein's drugstore. And he's been hitting on her for a month or so. And he convinces her to leave to go to Dallas with him. So they leave and they head to Dallas. Their first stop is South Carolina, where he convinces this girl, Anne, to marry him. So they continue their trip. They stay a few places. They get to Mississippi, and he uses an alias. He uses the name Roger Vaganoff, so he uses an alias. They also go to Oklahoma, but and before they go to Dallas on the same day, and he only spends 15 minutes talking to a guy. They go all the way to Oklahoma. He spends 15 minutes. That's it. And then they go to Dallas. Well, where do they go when they go to Dallas? They get an apartment on Sunset Boulevard in Oak Cliff. So they're living literally just a minute or two from Jack Ruby and Lee Oswald and 10th and Patton, where Officer Tippit will be killed. So he starts doing even stranger things. He visits on November 13th, he visits the Alamo Dry Cleaners on South Tyler Avenue in Oak Cliff. And then 3 days later, he goes back there to pick up his dry cleaning, and he makes this big scene. He tells the lady working there, Mrs. B. Collins, that he's a Russian national. And he makes this scene so intense that Collins calls the FBI. And the FBI do a quick look-see, but they deem that no further action is necessary. But when you think about it, think of all the fake Oswald sightings in and around Dallas in the 2 weeks before the assassination. You know, you've got the Lincoln Mercury dealership, you've got the rifle range, you've got some diners, you've got the ammunition being bought, and some other things. Well, his actions seemed to fit right in. Well, so was he another fake Oswald? Well, who knows, right? But anyway, he starts. So it's a week before the assassination now. So it's Monday before the assassination. Well, let me go back just a few days from there. From there, he starts acting crazy. He starts picking fights with his wife. Anne is her name. Her 18 years old, and he's quite a bit older than her because, you know, he's probably mid 20s to later. So she has a sister in Conroe, Texas. He's obviously acting a way that he has never acted before, and it's so bad that Anne calls her sister in Conroe, Texas. Her sister and her husband come to the apartment in Oak Cliff, and the sister is appalled that this guy is ranting and raving against Jews and blacks. He shows her a copy of Mein Kampf, and he also tells her that he's a member of the Aryan master race. This is stuff that he's never done before. This guy is really highly intelligent. He speaks four languages fluently, so he's obviously trying to lay down some kind of a wacky trail. So the whole story is wacky, really. But anyway, now it's Monday before the assassination, which will take place on Friday. And he starts leaving his apartment at 7 o'clock and coming back at 5 o'clock or just after 5 o'clock, like he has found a job. Well, it turns out that he did work for 1.5 days at the Texas Consumer Finance Company on Commerce Street. So it's the first floor that Jack Ruby's Carousel Club is on the second floor. So not only is it Oak Cliff, but he's in the same building as Jack Ruby. That's also where Lee Oswald will have worked for 2 weeks earlier at exactly that same location. So it's really starting to get interesting now. So he goes from 7 o'clock until he comes back at about 5 o'clock, and now he's doing that Monday through Thursday. So it comes time for Friday. So what happens? He doesn't leave at 7 o'clock. He stays in his apartment. And at 12:45, and that's verified by a lot of people, he leaves the apartment. He tells his wife that he's gone to the bank, and he speaks to his landlord, a guy named Claude Sharp. He's seen by Sharp's wife. He's wearing khaki pants and a light jacket, which is important because it'll get important because of the people that people like Mrs. Aquilla Clemens will describe later in the Tippit killing. But anyway, it's 15, 16 minutes after the shooting of John Kennedy, and he leaves his apartment. He says he's going to the bank, but he's never seen by anybody at the bank. There's no activity in his account, so he didn't obviously never went to the bank. Well, what's really important, what starts to get interesting here is that a Dallas Police Department confidential informant memo from a detective named H.M. Hart of the Criminal Intelligence Division to a Captain Pat Gannaway, who's head of Special Services Bureau, reports that a red Thunderbird convertible was parked outside Jack Ruby's apartment at the time of the Kip Tippett killing. So that's kind of wacky, you know? And then, of course, Mrs. Aquilla Clemens, she will report that she saw, a short, stocky guy and also a taller, thin guy who was wearing khaki pants and a white shirt. And then other people, like, we all know Domingo Benavides, Warren Reynolds, they don't identify Lee Oswald as a shooter, right? And the Tippett killing, at least right away, until they get more pressure put on them. So was Vaganoff or Vaganoff, was he a shooter? Well, who knows, because it's so crazy and no investigation really will ever be done. Well, what happens is most people who know the story about Tippett will know that behind a Texaco station, there is a jacket found that will later be attributed to being Lee Oswald's jacket that he took off in his escape from the Tippett murder scene. Well, inside will be a laundry tag, B9738. Actually, it's radioed in by H.H. Springer, a Dallas police sergeant, and it's identified as a gray man's jacket with a medium tag. They searched 424 launderettes in Dallas. They searched 293 more dry cleaners and launderettes in New Orleans. Nobody can find what this tag will, match up to. Well, Gaten Fonzie, the great Gaten Fonzie, he contacts the manufacturer of the jacket, Maurice Holman of California, who tells him, or representatives tell him, that most of the distribution of that jacket is done on the West Coast, and only Strawbridge and Clothier of Philadelphia handles and sells the jacket in the East. And we have to remember that that's where Vaganoff came from Philadelphia, just outside in the suburbs. I've been in that Strawbridge and Clothier store because I grew up in Northern Delaware, many times. And it was a really big store. So did the jacket, come from there? So anyway, there's a lot of people at the Tippett murder scene that say that the jacket certainly isn't the jacket that the Warren Commission says now is the jacket that was Oswald's. They say it was either too light, too dark, not gray enough, whatever. But not many people at all will state that the jacket that's that the Warren Commission will produce is the jacket that they saw one of the shooters wearing during the Tippit killing. Even Buell Wesley Frazier, who of course gave a ride to Lee Oswald to work that day, even he won't say that the jacket was the same. William Scroggins, the cab driver, won't say that that gray jacket was the jacket that he sees. So anyway, a lot of questions, right? Anyway, it gets even stranger because Vaganov, the night of the assassination, decides that he's going to drive back to Philly. And he gets back there in 2 days, which is a heck of a trip in those days because, you didn't have all the interstates and stuff, right? So he goes and he's got a newspaper proving that he was in Dallas on the day of the assassination on the 22nd. This is now the 24th. And he gives it to Orenstein and a couple of other people at the drugstore. But he tells them to throw it away, to get rid of it, to discard it. So he's obviously, again, trying to just lay down a some kind of a trap. Oh, I forgot a really important part here. And that is that one of the things that Vaganov did when he was pretending that he was a nut was that he says something to Anne, his wife, and on the night before the assassination, so it would have been November 21st, she calls again her sister in Conroe, Texas, and she won't tell her what Vaganov said, but she says he's going to do something terrible. And the sisters tell the mother and father, who they're in contact with back in the Philadelphia area, because they're worried about their daughter Anne, who's only 18 and has left with this guy to get married. Well, after the assassination of President Kennedy, the parents remember this story. And they call and they report it right away. And the FBI gets a hold of it. And they come out and they actually visit Vaganov back at his apartment in Oak Cliff around 3:30. Now, you would think that they would do some really pull this guy in and do some really serious investigation. But what do? They see that he's got a revolver. They see that he's got a long gun. They take the serial numbers, but that's it. They don't do anything else. So again, it doesn't get investigated when it was really just really low fruit. So anyway, again, on the 24th, 2 days after the assassination, this guy is back in Philadelphia and, getting even crazier because what he does is he buys another car. He buys a Chevrolet Stingray. And he puts his Thunderbird convertible, leaves it with a friend. And he calls that night, he calls the FBI and he says, "Hey, I had two agents that came to visit me 2 days ago, and I just wanted to let you all know that I'm going to be back in Dallas soon. And listen, I'm really worried about my wife. She's not answering the call, and I kind of think she might have my revolver. Well, he knows she's got to be at her sister's house in Conroe, Texas, but he doesn't say that. So he hustles back to, it seems to me what he's doing with that story is to try to make it some kind of a marital dispute story in order to even mix the waters up more so that when this is looked at later, they won't know whether this is just a husband and wife argument or what's going on. So anyway, he goes back 3 days later on the 27th. He's back. He goes right to Fort Conroe because he knows that's where his wife is. He convinces her to come back to Philly with him. She goes back. She only spends 2 days with him in Philly, and she leaves him for good. So this is a guy that had to get that leaves the service right before the assassination, 4.5 months before. He's obviously trying to get to Dallas by a certain period right before the assassination. When he can't get a transfer from his job at General Electric, he quits his job. He grabs a young lady that he knows he can manipulate, convinces her to marry him. They go to Oak Cliff. He's pretends that he's got a regular job for the 5 days before the assassination. He makes such a scene at the dry cleaners, telling people that he's a Russian national, that the FBI is called. Then when the day of the assassination, he doesn't go to work at 7 o'clock. He leaves at 12:45, right after John Kennedy is shot. His car is seen by a confidential informant outside of Jack Ruby's house. He's interviewed then just a couple hours later at 3:30 p.m. by the FBI because of reports that Anne's parents made, because of the what he said he was going to do something terrible the next day. They don't really investigate him. They just take down the serial number of his rifle and his revolver. He leaves that same night, the night of the assassination. He goes back to Philly with a newspaper from the assassination day, asks people to get rid of it for him. He buys a new car, very expensive. He goes back to Dallas, picks up his wife, back to Philadelphia, and that's the end of the story. Well, it seems to me, now maybe it's just me, but it seems to me that that is low-hanging fruit. Why the Warren Commission and the FBI and every agency in the world that was investigating the John Kennedy murder wouldn't feel the need to bring this guy in to really find out what was going on, if he was working for, intelligence, or whether he was just a nut, or whether he was there as a fake Oswald, or whether he wanted to just leave the jacket behind the Texaco, or whether he was actually a shooter of J.D. Tippit. You have to follow up on that story. But they did not. They did not follow up, which again is just an indication. It's just a confirmation that nobody in the CIA or FBI or Dallas police, the last people they wanted to interview was anybody that had anything to do with the actual assassination or the killing of Officer Tippit. The only people they brought in to testify before the Warren Commission were the people that would agree to verify their lone nut scenario story. And the fact that this Vaganov guy even existed and was never questioned about his activities, really, really, really strange activities, is just another one of those examples why it's obvious that the footprint of intelligence, Len, is just all over the JFK assassination. And I totally agree with you. What you said you think happened to Tippit, why he was killed. I absolutely agree with that. I don't think that he was going along with whatever, whether Oswald, who I believe was supposed to be killed earlier, I don't think he wanted to do whatever they were asking him to do at that point. And that was one of the reasons that, that he was killed. But I don't know, what do you think about this, Len? I mean, is this the strangest story that you've ever heard? What do you think?
No, it's just really unbelievable that you're able to find this and bring it to light, because there's so many stories like this that, just when we first heard from John Armstrong that there was a imposter, it was a Harvey and Lee, there was two of them, you go, what do you mean two of them? And then you look into his work and you go, oh, there was two. And then who was taken down to the Trinity River and flown out of town,
Right,
I
right.
mean, that's just. Now you can see there's so many, more than two, maybe three or four. And maybe
Yep.
they had already, plans for different people in different cities. I mean, I don't know if I ever told you this, but I got a phone call from Edwin Black one day, and he come across with something I posted up there, and he goes, "Why did you post this up there?" And I said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I thought you had passed away, and I didn't think anybody else remembered this story, and I just wanted to put it out there." And so I actually read your article, and he goes, "Okay, well, I'm just going to think about this, and I'll call you back." And then he never called me back. So it w was interesting that some of these stories, they don't see the light of day. There's many of them, and this is very good research on your part. I can tell, I think it's only like 2 weeks ago, you've already got 50,000 views on that one video. So this is just another footprint in the trail of intelligence operations, not a lone nut, not a lone Marxist, you know, and
And
not Lee Oswald, yeah.
another interesting thing too is that Edwin Black, he makes it clear that he looked up Motto and Stocks who were trailing the anti-Castro Cuban types and did the interviews all night long. He looked them up and he looked up Strzola and Growth, the two guys that were following Thomas Vallée. And you know what? They all this amazes me. It just really proves they all would not even admit that they remembered that night. So what they would they, obviously they were all told to say the same thing. They like Motto and Stocks would say, "Gosh, you know, I might have interviewed somebody that was you know, those Cuban type shooters the night before." Is that ridiculous or what? Are you mean to tell me that they actually, you know, well, obviously they didn't think they would get away with it, but that was the story. The story, what they, I mean, the what they were ordered, I'm sure, was if you're ever asked about this, say that you don't remember, you know. And it's just crazy because it just proves that the orders had to come from above. Just the way when you think about the whole Chicago plot, you know, why wasn't the Chicago plot, why wasn't it national news? It should have been the biggest news, you know, of the month, of, you know, that there were shooters that were arrested, that there were two plots to kill President Kennedy. Well, it wasn't because Secret Service head James Rowley, he called the Secret Service agent in charge, Maurice Martineau, in Chicago, and ordered him to bottle it up almost completely. And that included something that had never been done. He told, they ordered all of the agents that were involved in the investigation in Chicago, they ordered them to give oral reports, to not write written reports, to just give oral reports. And then they bottled it up in a through a bureaucratic, and I can't remember the there's a word for it, but they bottled up all of those reports to where they could never, or at least not easily, be seen. If that's not an indication that they were that they that there were that they knew that there would be other attempts in Tampa and Dallas or wherever that would be coming up in the next week or two, I don't think how you can look at that any other way. They wanted the assassination done in November, and you know, come hell or high water, they were going to make sure it got done in Dallas. So, you know, this Chicago plot stuff, and again, all props to Edwin Black, because he was the one that did all the hard research, including looking up every one of these people involved and you know, interviewing them in depth. I'm sure he bugged the hell out of them in order to even get the story out of them that they couldn't remember. I'm sure he had to call them 50 times each just to get that much information. But you know, the Chicago plot is I've just always felt that that is a key to the Kennedy assassination, you know, 3 weeks later, and that not enough emphasis has ever been placed on that. And I don't know about anybody else, but you know, my FOIA attempts in Chicago have gotten nowhere. You know, when I'm trying to find out any additional information, you know, I've been there pestering people twice and I get nowhere, you know, which tells me, I mean, not that I can prove it or anything, but it just tells me that an active cover-up is still ongoing about, you know, what happened back in 1963 there, and that I don't know. I mean, I don't know how anybody's ever gonna pry that information out. But how can you interview two people that you're accusing of, two people that you're accusing of getting ready to shoot the president of the United States the next morning? How can you interview those two guys all night long and not even have a record of what their names were, you know, what was in their wallets, you know, that kind of stuff? They were just let go. That to me just speaks volumes how they could have the audacity to think that they could get away with it, and yet they have gotten away with it for 60 some years now. You know, it's just that's why, you know, when people say, oh, the JFK assassination will never be solved, it'll never be solved, da 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 da, I totally disagree with it. I think that there's still so much information out there, and I think that, you know, somehow, some way, there's going to be one or two or three of these nuggets that are somehow pried loose or by reason or by accident or something else that might break the dam a little bit. Or I've often said that I think that a lot of people involved probably kept some proof just as protection for themselves. In case anything ever came back to them, they'd always have some ammunition to fire back with to say, hey, don't lay this on me, because I will release this or this or this. I've always had hope that one of those two, you know, scenarios might come true, and that we can finally, you know, come to an understanding of just how massive the JFK assassination was. I may be, you know, speaking out my butt, but at least I still have hope of that, Len.
Well, the number one thing is that we really proved that the official government story is a, I mean, you've got one good video here, 10 examples proving the Warren Commission was a sham,
Yeah.
right? So there you go. There's half an hour of that. I urge people to watch that. And of course, I mean, if you believe that, you know, welcome to the Flat Earth Society that thinks the Warren Commission had it right, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, at least, you know, thank you so much for having me on as a guest, because, you know, your show has been the gold standard of JFK assassination research for 20 years or however long you've been on, and you know, you've got everybody and anybody. So it's really an honor to every time I get a shot to, you know, just come on and throw on my two cents. So, you know, thank you for letting me be with you, Len.
Yeah, and thanks for your segment in 50 Reasons for 50 Years that you went over that section in Chicago, and that was that was great. And I think yeah, that series stands the test of time, but they're short. We me and Jeff Carter planned them for short attention span. Like somebody's got 3 to 5 minutes that they would maybe, you know, the gun, the route, the this or that. Who was Lee Oswald? Who was, you know, all the different things. So, that's how that came about. And of course, it was 2013 was the 50th anniversary. Now there's been a 60th. And of course, Cyril Wecht is not with us anymore. And we're standing on the shoulders of giants, people who first generation researchers dug up so much. But there is more out there, and it's a narrow incident in history. But if you're interested, the more you dig into it, the more you find. And thanks to you. With your research, people are finding even more and more. And, you know, keep up the good work as well.
Thank you, and I really, really appreciate that,
Yeah. And
especially coming from you.
like what you're mentioning about James Files or Judy Baker, some other things, there's disinformation. People have got nothing but time on their hands, and they go, hey, you know, yeah. They asked me to be a shooter. Yeah, just that morning I was having coffee and they said, hey, let's overthrow the government. What are you doing at noon? Well, I'm free. Okay.
That's the way I look at it, and it makes me laugh too when I think about like some of these stories. It's just absolutely it's just hilarious. But he is a good storyteller. So again, anybody who has kind of fallen into that rabbit hole, you know, again, I have fallen into my share of rabbit holes over the years, believe me. So, it's taken me time to do research or come up with other information that has, and then I look at it and say to myself, how the heck did I ever believe this in the first place? So, anybody that's maybe had fallen for James Files's story and now goes, how the heck could I have fallen for it? Well, he's a good storyteller, so don't feel bad. That's how we progress is by looking at everything. And then, we throw out the extraneous stuff and we try to keep the facts and we move along, a little bit at a time. And and that's why Black Op Radio is so great, because we hear from so many different people. I can't tell you how many times I forget things and then I have to go back and I look up a guest that you've had, Len, and then I say, oh yeah, that's now I remember, and that's why your show is such a treasure,
Well, thanks. And
so
Jim
good.
Garrison had a term for that. They were called golden apples, that these little tidbits that people left out to trip up researchers, just to leave things that look too good to be true, like for instance, files, right? And I don't spend much time critiquing. I'm kind of happy about that the people that I don't really subscribe to, I just don't have them on. I just or somebody, my co-host before Anita suggested one or two people, and then on her behalf I said, okay, well, let's interview them, right? And then never again. Just like, no, there's just they're not telling the truth. There's something wrong there. There's just something wrong. And when you find out from the investigations of USAID about how much money they have for this info stuff, how the guys like Posner will go out there and every time there's something out, they call him. Oh, what do you think of this new file release? Oh, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. Okay, thanks, Gerald, and then go back to sleep, right? It's
That's a
disgusting.
guy that he just drives me crazy. He really does.
Oh, there was McAdams before him too. And there's a couple of new
Another.
people around that all they do is sit and criticize all day long instead of doing any research and digging up. Okay, this is what I found. Oh, you know what? I found it. More information. Lee did it. He actually did it now because look at we've got A, B, and C. No, that doesn't happen at all. In fact, the more you look into it, you might. Hey, they faked these photographs. They faked these X-rays. They've up. Stuff is missing. How can all this stuff be missing? And all I'd say is the intelligence community got it right this time with that shooting in I forget the name of the city, Pittsburgh, but the Trump shooting, right? There's nothing. There's no transcripts, evidence, something, that'll be found in the National Archives here. There's just nothing.
It's amazing, amazing stuff.
Okay, well, thank you for your kind words on the Fletcher Prouty documentary.
Oh
And
yeah. Yeah.
I guess we'll wrap it up. I'll make a link to Ted Yacucci's the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Geez, you've got 87 videos. Yeah, you were close. 87 videos up there.
My gosh.
Yeah. And well worth it. And thanks again for taking time. Just before we wrap up, then, anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think I got out everything that I wanted to. Thanks for letting me rant there. I appreciate it.
No, it's of interest, and it might be a narrow group of people who are interested, but for anyone, they're gonna listen to this and then go through your videos.
Great.
That's
Thank you
really
so
good
much,
work.
Len.
All right. Okay, we'll talk again
All
and
right.
keep in touch.
Have a great one. Bye.
Okay, bye.